Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my partner, Tim McConville. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Wayne. Good to be here.
He's our special guest, and let me tell you a little bit about Tim and his practice, and he'll tell us a little bit more about it. He's a principal in the labor and employment practice at Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, and represents employers in all aspects of the employer-employee relationship. His experience includes defending Fortune 500 and multinational corporations, as well as small and mid-sized employers in litigation and agency matters. He's defended employers in Virginia, Maryland, and all across the country. He specializes in counseling management in labor and employment issues, and he emphasizes timely analysis and practical solutions to accomplish organizational goals and legal compliance. Previously, Tim was vice president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. He has significant experience in helping employers maintain a union-free environment, and he's recognized in the best lawyers in America and named one of Virginia's legal elite by Virginia Business Magazine. It's a pleasure to have you here finally. I've been trying to get you on the show for a long time to talk about labor and employment issues. First of all, when did you join Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman?
It was 3 years ago.
3 years ago, right. And you came from another fairly large firm out of Tidewater. How big is our employment and labor practice? It's pretty substantial, isn't
sure,
it?
Sure, yeah. We have five lawyers practicing, counseling employers in all aspects of labor and employment law. We get a lot of employers calling with this situation or that situation, and you know, just when you think you've seen everything, they come up with something new in the workplace. And so we do a fair amount of work in that regard. We also are litigating, defending employers against employee claims in the courts. And then we're also defending employers, helping them maintain union-free environments, and then interacting with organized labor unions when they are in the workplace.
Have you seen an increase in union activity since the president was elected?
I've seen certainly an increase in union legislative activity.
Right.
And excuse me, and in union regulatory activity, if you want to call it that. The National Labor Relations Board in particular has been very, very active in pursuing objectives of organized labor in a regulatory fashion as opposed to passing legislation through the Congress.
So we're going to talk about the National Labor Relations Act, which is really an act that deals with unions. To whom does it apply? Who does the NLRA apply to?
The vast majority of private sector employees and employers in the United States. There are certain industries that are excluded from it and are covered by the Railway Labor Act, the airlines and trains.
They have their own specific rules.
They've got their own. That's right. They've got their own law. And apart from that, if you're a private sector employee or employer, you're covered by the National Labor Relations Act as long as you're engaged in interstate commerce.
So if we've got a government contractor, which is a pretty prevalent practice area that we represent at our firm, and they have multi-state activities, interstate commerce, they're in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C., as an example, they could be subject to the National Labor Relations Act?
Most likely they are.
And yeah. So what is regulated under the Act? What is the act intended to accomplish?
It was intended in 1935, at the height of the New Deal, to accomplish the organization of workers into unions. The federal labor policy of the United States believes and espouses that having unions in the workplace is a good thing because it, again, in theory, helps to eliminate work stoppages and eliminate disruptions to commerce. That was the policy theory behind the statute.
Interesting.
And so Franklin Delano Roosevelt and others enacted the law in 1935, and the idea was we need to kind of avoid the disruptions. We're going to get employees, enact this mechanism by which employees and by which unions can organize the workers in particular workplaces. It set up a mechanism by which employees can and unions can solicit card signing signatures, some indicia of support among the rank and file once they get to a certain level, they will petition the National Labor Relations Board for a certification election, and the board comes in and conducts a secret ballot election among the employees in the bargaining unit. If 50% plus one of those voting vote in favor of the particular union at issue, then the union becomes the exclusive bargaining agent for all of the employees in that bargaining unit. And
bargaining unit pertaining to a particular employer or a corporation or an entity.
That's right. It pertains to that particular employer, and even inside of that particular employer to particular classifications of employees. And so, and that's part of what goes on before the election. There's some degree of litigation or negotiation and such over the issue of what's the appropriate bargaining unit, what jobs are going to be in that bargaining unit, and which ones would be excluded from that bargaining unit.
What typically is included in the bargaining unit? What types of jobs are union oriented? I mean, who usually forms a union?
Well, the historically, the organized labor has had a lot of success in the industrial Northeast and manufacturing,
right,
and so on. More recently, they've been very successful in the public sector, in organizing state and local workers around the country. That kind of activity is not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. Those are creatures of a state law or local law.
Okay.
But in a lot of ways, those places are enacting statutes that are very similar to the National Labor Relations Act, again, that provides some mechanism by which unions can become the monopoly bargaining representative of the employees in a particular state workplace.
Do the employees usually group together by the type of function, or will it? Let's say I've got a government contractor and they've got employees performing, you know, technology jobs, and then there's those performing clerical jobs. Would they all be in the same union or same bargaining unit?
Yes, Wayne, they could be. It could be what I call a wall-to-wall unit, which is everybody that's not a supervisor in that workplace could be in the same unit. On the other hand, the unit could consist of all of the technicians, all of the laborers could be in a separate one, the machinists in a separate one.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. A lot of that begins with the union and the petition that the union has prepared and filed with the National Labor Relations Board. But you can get different permutations from the employer's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, in my experience, most employers don't want anything to do with having an outside third party with no interest in the success of that workplace coming in and acting as some kind of a go-between between employees and the employer.
I could see that. I mean, I represent a lot of entrepreneurs and small business owners. I certainly could see them objecting to a third party coming in to try to negotiate for their workers in terms of benefits and all the other things that are covered under these collective bargaining agreements. What types of things are covered under these agreements? What types of things do unions try to negotiate?
Well, the big ticket items are wages, benefits. One of the things that organized labor is typically insistent upon, if the state law allows it, is the power to compel all of the employees in that bargaining unit to pay union dues as a condition of employment. So it ends up being kind of a pay up or be fired,
mm-hmm,
situation. And so that is something that is a top priority. They call it union security. They can dress it up in various different ways, but to the individual employee, it means pay up or be fired. And to the employer, it can mean a dramatic increase in the power of the union in that workplace. Because if the union has 100% of the unit
participating,
paying dues, not only paying dues, it could be unwillingly paying dues,
right,
but paying dues and subject, therefore, to union discipline. If you don't, in other words, if you don't do this or if you don't do that, then the union's going to have some disciplinary process internally to the union that it can exercise against the individual employee. But that's the point. So that's why the union can obtain a tremendous amount of power by having the power to compel employees to pay union dues as a condition of employment. That power exists under the NLRA in 28 states around the country. That is the 28 states that do not have a state right to work law. Now, our offices are in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the Commonwealth of Virginia has a long history in the right-to-work principles. It has a right-to-work statute on the books, and there are 21 other states like it. Maryland is not a right-to-work state, and so in the state of Maryland, you can have the union in a workplace of a particular employee agreeing with the employer to compel all of the employees in that workplace to pay
the dues.
To pay union dues.
That's so right. Maryland and Virginia are very divergent when it comes to union activity.
That's right. And, you know, from my point of view, I think that gives Virginia a great competitive advantage. And if you listen to Governor McDonnell and any of the leadership in Virginia over a long decades, really, they are very active in promoting Virginia's right to work culture and the flexibility that we have in our workplaces.
Now, there have been changes to the NLRA, or at least changes proposed, right? And tell us a little bit about that. What's been going on in Congress with regard to labor relations?
Well, you know, organized labor was very insistent over the last few years on making changes to the National Labor Relations Act. They'd been pushing a bill known as the Card Check Bill, and it essentially would have eliminated the employer's right to insist on a secret ballot election for its employees. That was a kind of a staple under the statute for decades.
For establishing a union in the workplace.
Since the beginning, that's right. And that the employer could question whether the union really represents a majority and insist that there be an NLRB-conducted secret ballot election.
I see. Who wanted to do away with this?
Big labor.
Okay.
Their numbers in terms of private sector union membership had dropped from the early 50s when they were at a point of about 35% of the workforce, of the private sector workforce, was a union membership. So it went from that point down to, in 2010, it was 6.9%, something like that.
Well, that's drastic.
Tremendous drop. And that has a tremendous impact on organized labor's treasuries.
Were these changes enacted? Yeah. I mean, where are they in the process?
No, they were not enacted, and they had a golden opportunity, organized labor did, and they did not succeed in passing it during the first 2 years of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
when their control over the Congress was at really their highest point. So they failed in that regard. Since then, organized labor has been pursuing their agenda through the regulatory process, through the National Labor Relations Board, and specifically through rulemaking. That is, the NLRB is proposing new rules. One of the new rules that the board is proposing is to enact a new process for doing elections, they're commonly known as quickie elections. They want to change the time by which elections are done. Right now, the median time from the filing of the NLRB certification petition is 37 to 38 days, something like that. From that to election is 37 days. They want to change that to 10 to 21 days. That change would be dramatic. It would dramatically increase organized labor's ability to control workplaces all over the country.
We're talking with Tim McConville. Tim, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they find you at Odenfeldman & Pittleman?
They can call me at 703-218-2000. 703-218-2119, 703-218-2119.
Excellent. Thanks for being a guest on Blueprint for Wealth. Obviously, if you're listening to this and you have a labor and employment question, call Tim at 218, what's the last four digits?
2119.
2119, and he'll help you out. Thanks for listening to Blueprint for Wealth, and tune in next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.